Hey, Daniel, if you had a tough problem to solve, who would you ask?
I guess it depends on the problem. Is it like a particle physics calculation or something like a tooth extraction?
Well, what if you wanted to do a tooth extraction with particle physics?
Well, you know, usually you get the ideas nailed down and then you just sort of hand it off to an engineer and they figure out the details.
Like engineers are just your assistants. Like, we're just there to fix your problems.
You know, they're downstream. That's all I got to say. I don't know which position's better.
Downstream.
You start with the math and then the physics.
Oh, I see. You mean the bad ideas just flow down.
We flush them down to the engineers and the engineers turn it into gold.
It's trickle down physics, I guess. It's a new concept. Right.
But at the very top, of course, are the comics.
Hi, I'm Jorge, I'm a cartoonist and the creator of PhD Comics.
Hi, I'm Daniel. I'm a particle physicist, which puts me solidly downstream on the intellectual river from cartoonists, but above engineers. Thank you very much. And I'm a professor at UC Irvine, where I actually do experimental particle physics for a living. And I'm the co-author of our book, We Have No Idea, A Guide to the Unknown Universe.
Yeah, and so welcome to our podcast, Daniel and Jorge Explain the Universe, a production of iHeartMedia.
In which we examine all things crazy and awesome about the universe, things far away, things nearby. We ask all sorts of questions on this podcast.
And so today we'll be answering a couple of questions, but we're going to do things a little bit differently today. So first of all, we're going to be answering how-to questions. And second of all, we're going to be doing it with arguably the world's worst expert on how-to questions.
So this is, in some sense, another episode of Ask the Wrong Expert. But is this guy an expert in everything or nothing?
Well, if you are on the internet, if you have access to the internet, which we're guessing you have because you're listening to this podcast.
Thank you, DARPA.
Yeah, thank you. Thank you, government agencies. And you have an interest in physics and science and math and geeky stuff, then you've probably most likely have come across the work of our special guest today.
For those of you listening, on today's podcast, I will be the only one who is not a famous web comic.
And I'll be the only one who does not have a degree in physics.
One of these things is not like the other one in every sense of the word.
And so today on the podcast, we have New York Times number one bestselling author of What If? And the creator of the super popular web comic XKCD, Randall Monroe. Welcome, Randall.
Hey, thanks for having me.
It's super special to have you here today because not only are you a roboticist who turned into cartooning just like me, but it's pretty cool because you're also—
Hey, I'm feeling kind of left out here. Do I have to have a robotics degree to be on this podcast?
We'll find a connection for you a little later, Daniel. Yeah, you used to work at NASA, right, Randall?
Yeah, I worked there on 3D vision stuff for a while as an intern and then got hired to work in a robotics lab on robotic navigation.
Cool. And at some point you decided to become a cartoonist?
Yeah, I was working on a contract basis at NASA, and at the same time I was posting my comics that I had was mostly like doodles from my old notebooks. I was scanning them in and putting them on my website. And then at some point, people started sharing those around and asking if they could order T-shirts or prints of them. And then before I knew it, I was like spending a fair amount of time shipping merchandise and handling that stuff. And so when my contract ran out at NASA, I didn't push them to take me back. I was just like, maybe I'll try doing this comics thing for a little bit.
And I've noticed on your website, you have all of the old original ones, like including like number zero. Mm-hmm. And I wonder sometimes, like, you ever thought about like, you know, going back and editing it, or do you keep all those on there for inspiration for future people trying to launch their own side careers? Or
I don't know. I try not to do the thing where I go back and add CGI, Banthas walking past the camera and stuff. But you know, I just think of it as like I posted it, and that's like the record of old stuff I've put up.
Yeah, you gotta respect the archive, right?
Yeah, exactly.
Cool. Do you miss robotics, Randall? Working in robots?
I don't know. What I like about comics is that when I can think of an idea for a robot and then draw it, and then it'll do what I want to draw it doing. Whereas in real life, building a robot, like way more of it was spent like debugging sensors and trying to figure out why, like, why will this half of it not turn on? Everything is working right. It works right when I take it out of the robot. What's different? You know, that kind of frustrating debugging. So comics are fun because you can kind of skip all of that because you get to just draw the robot doing what you want it to do.
The real world is very frustrating sometimes. I agree.
Well, thank you for joining us today, Randall. I know that you've been crisscrossing the country and giving talks and giving book signings to talk about your new book, which is called...
It's called How To, Absurd Scientific Advice for Common Real World Problems.
Yeah. And so it's an awesome book. If anyone out there is listening and wants just a really fun read to learn about science and physics and do it in a way that is intriguing and interesting. So tell us a little bit about what the book is about and maybe a little bit about how you thought about the idea for the book.
Well, I'm always thinking of like wildly impractical ways to do things, which isn't usually my goal. I'll just be like looking at a task, and especially if it's something that's kind of repetitive or menial or like, you know, boring that I have to do a bunch of times, and I'll think like, are there any other ways I could do this? And I'm not trying to think of bad ideas, you know, but most of them are bad ideas, or at least impractical in one way or another. But what I find is like going over those ideas and kind of taking them seriously for a moment, like as a hypothesis, and then thinking like, how would this work? What problems would I run into? And like, what would the side effects of doing it with this way be? How hard would it be? How expensive would it be? That's always really fun. It's like, I like that kind of analysis because I really like doing math and engineering and planning when there's like a cool goal in mind. I always have a hard time with when math gets really abstract, for example. Like I see an equation on a board and I'm just like, oh, I hope I don't have to solve that. But if that equation will tell me whether or not I can attach engines to my house and make it fly into the air, like suddenly I'm way more interested. So I always like practical applications.
I thought you told me earlier you were a physicist. What is this interest in like real world applications?
Well, oh no. So I feel like I get along so well with everyone who does physics. And I think the reason... might be like the way I see it is that physics is for people who are too practically oriented to go into like pure math, but then at the same time, like not concerned enough with details and implementation to be engineers. So if you wander back and forth between like the theoretical and the practical, you have to walk that like narrow path, but that takes you into physics. Because if you're too interested in the abstract structures that, you know, theoretical structures explaining things, you get peeled off into like algebraic geometry eventually and that has no connection to reality.
Yeah, who needs Lie algebra, right?
But like if you actually try to build
can I interject? Right? Actually, abstract algebra has a deep, deep connection to reality, underlies all of fundamental
physics.
Right.
I feel bad.
The connection that is that it funds a whole bunch of mathematicians and physicists
I always feel bad using algebraic geometry as my example of a thing that I'm not interested in because I'm like, I'm so sorry to any algebraic geometrists. Out there. But yeah, then, but like at the same time, like I want a practical application, et cetera. But then like actually building robots, I quickly get frustrated with like the practical aspects of it and just want to think like theoretically, how would this robot work if I had solved all these minor engineering problems? So like, right in between the theoretical and the practical.
I totally agree with you though. The best part of the problem is when you can just hand it off to the engineers and say, make it work for less than $1 trillion, please. We figured out all the theory, now make it work.
Yeah. But, we were talking earlier a bit about how it's sort of not just about making something or achieving something or getting to somewhere. It's about what sometimes you discover along the way and what you're in the process of getting there, where your curiosity sort of leads you and finding new things that you maybe didn't think about.
Yeah, I really find that a lot of the time, especially with computers, I'll have an idea for how to automate something that will save, and I think it'll take a lot of work now, but it'll save me time in the long run. And it never saves me time in the long run. Like it's always, I would have been better off just continuing to do it the other way.
Right. But you feel smarter.
But in the process of building the automation tool, I'll like learn to use some software library that doesn't actually help me with the problem I'm working on. But now I know how to use that software and then later on, when there's a problem where it is actually really helpful, I have a head start already. Like I've already learned how to use it. So sometimes like solving a ridiculous, contrived thought experiment or word problem or analyzing a plan that definitely won't work will teach you something that then is helpful with solving something else. And then also it's just sometimes really fun.
And so that's kind of what your whole book is about, how to answering absurd scientific advice for common real world problems. You sort of go into how to do sometimes simple, even simple or seemingly simple tasks, and you sort of follow your curiosity and find kind of the sometimes the worst possible way to do it, but where you sort of learn a lot and think about cool science.
I've always like hated moving because you have to pack. It's so disruptive to your life and just takes over everything and takes so much work. And I started thinking like, okay, is there a way I can avoid packing all these boxes? And I was thinking, you know, my house is already a boxy structure. All my stuff is in there. Could I just lift the entire house? And like, there's no way that's going to end up being less work than just packing the boxes. But, you know, I'm going to, let's
maybe,
try exploring.
Maybe.
Yeah, just maybe, you know, because sometimes, like almost all the time, it's pretty clear, you know, this isn't going to be a bad idea. But like sometimes you never know. Whoever was the first person to, you know, when like if you get a cut and you're like, oh man, this looks red and swollen, it looks pretty bad. I'm going to take some of this mold from a sandwich and just rub it on it. Like that sounds definitely like a bad idea, but like that's penicillin. That's how that works. And that like.
Is that the true story, the discovery of penicillin?
Yeah, that's exactly how they did it. Yeah, no.
I think it involved the Earl of Sandwich, actually.
Oh, yeah.
And the Duke of Penicillin, yeah. It was a joust.
It's not like these weird ideas always turn out to be good, because like there's a lot of stuff that you could rub on an infected wound and it would make it much worse.
There's a long trail of bodies of people who rub things into their wound, but the one person who picked the right mold survived.
That's right. And we can't interview dead people on the podcast, which is why you're here today and not all those other folks. But I think there's a really interesting lesson here that connects, you know, not just engineering, but also physics and just following your curiosity. And sometimes you discover stuff that's totally unexpected. And, you know, on this podcast a lot, we talk about these things like you're interested in X and then along the way you discover Y and the universe is filled with fun mysteries to unravel. And so that's part of the joy of doing physics. And sometimes abstract geometry.
All right, I'll learn abstract geometry.
We just got to come up with a good
goal
for him to that will require learning about that.
If you want to move, you can turn your whole moving process into a computer script if you learn algebraic geometry. I promise.
All right, we'll talk.
/move.sh.
All right, so today in the program, we are going to be asking you, Randall, and we're going to be trying to answer together three how-to questions. And so the first one on the list is one directly from your book. But before we keep going, let's take a short break.
I love your book. I thought it was hilarious. And for those of you out there who are interested in science with a healthy dose of silly humor, then, you know, that's probably why you're listening to this podcast. You're going to really enjoy this book. But make sure when you're reading it, you're not in a public place or people will think you're weird for giggling so much. But one of my favorite chapters was this one, chapter 26, How to Get Somewhere Fast. And, you know, it talks all about, you know, movement on Earth. But one of the most fascinating bits is at the end, you're talking about how to get around the universe, right? And how, especially if you wanted to get to the edge of the universe.
In a fast way. Is that the idea? Like what's the fastest way to get to the end of the universe?
Yeah, well, I was thinking about how, you know, there are all these limits of like the speed of light and stuff that limit how quickly you can get somewhere. But there are also the more practical limits. If you want to travel from here, you know, to across the country or across town or whatever, most of the time you're limited by traffic or whatever. But if you are able to get rid of all of those limitations, you've still got a kind of fundamental limit by how fast the human body can accelerate. And over really brief intervals, people can handle fairly high accelerations, especially if you're a fighter pilot and you have one of those suits where it compresses your legs so the blood doesn't all drain from your head. Over longer periods of time, we don't do great if we're accelerated faster than 1G, you know, like Earth gravity.
That's when our body squishes?
Yeah.
Or is that just when we pass out?
No, like the idea is that like we're always existing at one Earth gravity of acceleration. Because Earth's gravity is pulling us down. And so, you know, your blood is, you know, being pulled down to your feet when you're just standing. Which is why, like, if you like injure something, you're supposed to elevate it to like keep it, I don't know, from keep it from bleeding as much.
I think this is something a lot of people don't really realize. They're aware of the fact that there's a speed limit to the universe. Yeah. They don't think often about how long it would take to get to that speed limit, right? They imagine, yeah. Oh, you just press a button and zoom, you're going half the speed of light or three quarters the speed of light.
Yeah. If you made a rocket that, you know, you press a button and it moves and it just accelerates up to the speed of light. If it does it, you know, in a week, that will crush you. You'll be crushed against the back of the room you're in by the acceleration, and you'll just be a puddle in the back of the rocket.
Man. And no amount of mold will help you at that point. Or sandwiches.
could actually be turned into a pretty tasty sandwich at that point. You know?
So you're saying that there's a speed limit to the universe, but there's also kind of an acceleration limit to the human body.
Yeah, and this acceleration limit is actually, it does have sort of practical consequences here on Earth. Generally, our modes of acceleration don't involve accelerating at 1G, you know, at this high speed, especially, you know, it gets added on to the gravity that we're already feeling. So if your car accelerates too fast and you're pressed back into the seat, it's uncomfortable, you know, so.
But how many Gs is that? Say you have a Lamborghini, for example.
Yeah, I think that the very fastest cars will do about 1G of acceleration sideways. And that's on top of the 1G already pulling you downward. And because of the way you add, you know, forces that are in different directions, it means you'll be experiencing a total of about 1.4 Gs diagonally.
So towards your butt.
Yeah. And that's okay. You can handle that for a while. It doesn't feel that comfortable. But at that acceleration, it takes you, you know, a good 30, 45 minutes to get around the world. Because you have to accelerate up and then you have to accelerate back down at the other side.
Oh, so if you do the math and accelerate at that speed, at that acceleration, and then right away start decelerating at that
Rate,
then it would take you how long to go around the world?
To get to the other side of the world would be like 30, 45 minutes in that range. There are some funny details there. Like if you accelerate fast enough and you get up to a high enough speed, because of the curve of the Earth, there's sort of the centrifugal force flinging you outward that cancels out gravity. And so if you're moving at like orbital speed, you don't actually feel any acceleration from gravity, which means you could afford to do a little bit more acceleration forward because you would have less force on your body that, you know, you have more acceleration budget to work with. But then if you go too fast, the curve, trying to follow the curve of the Earth, you have to, it's like you're being swung against the outside of a curved wall as you're going around it too fast. And that, you know, centripetal acceleration, depending on how you do it, that starts to become a problem. So just like if you go too fast, sticking to the Earth is hard. That takes extra force and extra stress on your body.
So if you wanted to go at light speed and stay on the Earth's surface, which sounds like a dangerous way to drive your Lamborghini, that'd be pretty true.
Yeah, that'd be definitely a scenario where you end up as a puddle on the wall of whatever vehicle you're in.
Am I the only one here who doesn't have a Lamborghini? Did I miss out on the
You don't the get to use up? The official podcast Lamborghini? Oops. There's a sign-up sheet outside. You should just sign up.
I know so little. All I know is that car sounds fast and expensive. I don't actually know if it's a good high accelerator. Car.
But if you wanted to accelerate to the speed of light, it's interesting, you know, at one, then basically you're saying you have to accelerate at 1G.
Yeah.
And that would take a shockingly long time.
Yeah. It's actually kind of weird to me that it's a really long time. If you're going to accelerate for more than, you know, a few minutes in a car or whatever, you want it to be at Earth gravity. You want to accelerate at 1G and not any more than that. Cause like long term, it'll take a toll on you. And if you want to get up to the speed of light, if you ignore relativity for a moment and just think about how long it takes to get your speed up to around that range, it's about a year. Like
it takes you a year to ramp up to the speed of light?
Yeah, which is both really long but also weirdly short because I think of the speed of light as being unimaginably large. But it's weird. So it's weird that it's kind of within a human, you know, time frame.
Wait, I thought it was impossible to get to the speed of light. Are you saying like get up to 99% of the speed of light or what do you mean?
Yeah. Well, so I, you know, to get up into the range of the speed of light is on the range of a year. But as you start to get near it, things get a little bit more complicated because that's when relativity comes in and suddenly the math stops being like addition and subtraction and involves, you know, at least a few more symbols.
Yeah, it gets a little nonlinear, but it depends a little bit on how you state the question, right? If you state the question is how much acceleration are you achieving, then you can say, well, I'm accelerating by this certain amount. But if you, that takes more and more energy as you get closer and closer to the speed of light.
Oh, I see.
But it's also a funny sort of coincidence of numbers. Like the number of seconds in a year is about 3 × 10⁷. And the speed of light divided by Earth gravity is about 3 × 10⁷. Sort of a funny coincidence.
What?
It takes one Earth year to accelerate at 1G to 1C.
It's like we were. It's like we were meant to go at the speed of light.
I don't know. It also makes you wonder, like, if we were on another planet where the gravity was much, much stronger, right? Like, say we're on a super Earth somewhere and we could tolerate 5G, then we could be more of an interstellar species because we could accelerate at 5G, right? So some aliens out there are much better at exploring the universe than we are.
They'll get there five times faster.
They'll accelerate five times faster, right? They'll get to the speed of light faster. Oh. But, you know, in the end, if you're going 50 light years, you know, the time spent accelerating or decelerating doesn't actually matter very much. I think that's what you were saying.
Yeah, well, the funny thing is with relativity, when you subject yourself to that kind of acceleration, in one sense, from someone watching from the outside, it looks like you're getting up closer and closer to the speed of light, but then your speed kind of plateaus. But because of the way time is changing for you, you'd be plateauing, you know, your speed would be leveling off as you got near the speed of light. But they would also see all the clocks on board your ship running slower.
Oh, I was going to ask that. When you say it takes a year, does it take a year for me on the ship in my light-speed Lamborghini, or would it like take a year for someone watching me from the outside?
Well, for the first year or so, your clocks will be mostly in sync. And then as you get near that speed of light, they start to diverge. And it feels like your clock is still running normally. You're still under 1G of acceleration. And you see mile markers in the universe going by you faster and faster and faster. But part of the reason you're seeing them go by faster and faster and faster is because your clock has started running slower from the perspective of the rest of the universe. So to you, it feels like it's taking less and less time to pass each marker. But that's partly because your time is running slower on your ship.
Right. Or another way to look at it is you're stationary and the universe is moving past you faster and faster. And moving things gets shrunk by relativity. And so what's a mile to somebody else now becomes smaller and smaller distance to you. This whole relativity stuff is all mind-boggling, right? And the thing people should remember is that your clock always runs at 1 second per second, right? A clock that's sitting next to you, not moving relative to you, always runs normally. Other people's clocks always move slowly. So you're on the light-speed Lamborghini, you see Earth's clock running slowly, they see your clock running slowly. And the last crazy fact to remember is that people don't have to agree. Like on the Lamborghini, you can see one thing. On Earth, you can see another thing that seems to contradict. And everybody can be correct, even if they contradict each other. Because there's no actual absolute truth in the universe. It's all just relative.
The weirdest consequence of this, in my opinion, is like that as you're if you were able to keep accelerating at 1G, which right now we don't have a way to do. There are a couple of really wild proposals out there that involve nuclear bombs that I'm very into, but are probably not practical.
You guys
should
see
soon.
How much he's smiling when he says nuclear bombs. He says he's not into it, but
he's twiddling his thick fingers here.
This is why we're glad you just keep things theoretical and on paper and don't actually go build things.
Exactly. The nuclear bomb thing is something that a couple of theoretical physicists are very excited about. And all the people who actually have to deal with like the actual like nuclear material and stuff are like, what are you thinking? But so other than those weird proposals from the theoretical physicists, we don't have any technology that will let us accelerate at 1G. But we also don't have any clear reason to think it's impossible. So if we did have a way to do that and we were accelerating, we could get up within a year or so to near the speed of light and then the relativity starts to come in. But if we keep it, if you're in this Lamborghini, you keep accelerating at that speed at 1G, your clock starts running slower and it feels like you're moving faster and faster and faster. It feels like you're reaching other parts of the universe in less time than it should take you. So it's as if you're going faster than the speed of light. If you sit down and do the math on what that converges toward, like if you let 5, 10, 15 years go by on your ship, you'll get closer and closer to the speed of light. Your time will stretch out. So it's like you're living longer and longer. And it actually gives you time to reach way farther than you would otherwise.
Because you stop aging in a way.
Yeah. So
and
on
even
your
though
ship,
it may take a long time for people on Earth, you maybe could get to the other side of the universe.
Yeah. So trips across the galaxy, it might be like 100,000 light years. So it should take you 100,000 years moving at the speed of light. But after those first few years, you've gotten close enough to the speed of light that time on your ship is barely passing. So someone outside watching you, it'll still, you know, 10,000 years might pass in the universe, or 100,000 years might pass in the universe. But for you, very little time. You know, you'll get those first few years and then your clock slows to almost a stop.
Which is why so many listeners write in with the question, what is it like to be a photon? Because they wonder, like, can photons think? You know, is time frozen for a photon? And unfortunately, we've never been able to interview a photon on the podcast, so we don't know the answer.
We have him on our show all the time here in the room, but, you know, none of them stop to talk to us.
Yeah, for a photon, the entire universe has contracted to a single point. They have a single moment in time. Like, time doesn't pass for them at all because they are moving at the speed of light.
That's right, but how could you even build a clock or have a clock as a photon? Or how do you measure time as a photon? Because you can't build a clock out of light. Everything is moving at the speed of light relative to you. It's a funny, crazy, hard answer philosophy physics question.
I think they just have the new Apple Watches.
Well, the coolest thing about this 1G of acceleration is if you look at, like, okay, in a human lifetime, how far can you get? And you find that it takes you about 30 years to get to where you can go almost arbitrarily far, like crossing the entire observable universe. It, you know, billions of light years. And it's really, that's another weird coincidence that, like, the size of the universe is about how far you could go in one human lifetime at 1G of acceleration, thanks to relativity slowing down the clock for you.
Right. And that's the observable universe today. And of course, that's if the universe was sort of static and waiting around for you to do your tour. But of course, the universe is expanding, right? So
yeah, that's the problem. For you, it only takes 30 years, but for the rest of the universe, a lot of time passes. So the universe is expanding, and you'll feel like you're going faster and faster. But then you'll also be like, "Wow, the universe is getting bigger, faster and faster," and the expansion of the universe is accelerating, which, you know, we've recently learned. But to you, it would seem to be accelerating much faster. It would be doubling in size in a few years. So you would actually never be able to catch up to the edge of the universe, even if you could accelerate to near the speed of light.
Yeah, because the universe doesn't follow these rules, right? There's no speed limit to that.
Yeah, well, it sounds like that's the answer to the how-to question, which is, it seems like the answer is to just go for it, right? Like, don't mess around. Don't go at half the speed of light. Don't go at 3/4 of the speed of light. Just keep going. Otherwise, you're going to die of old age on the way.
Yeah, once they introduce a 1G Lamborghini.
So, let's talk to Elon Musk about that.
The Italian Elon Musk.
All right, that was great. And so we have another how-to question for you, Randall. This one about dinosaurs and black holes. But first, let's take a quick break. All right, we're answering questions today with a super special guest, Randall Monroe of XKCD Comics and the author of the new book, How To: Absurd Scientific Advice for Common Real World Problems.
And so we had a listener actually write in with a totally relevant question for you. It's a absurd scientific question with maybe a real world solution. And so here's a question from a listener.
Hi, Daniel and Jorge. My name's Chris, and I'm an avid listener from North Carolina. I've read about how scientists can resolve images of stellar objects behind galaxy clusters that have been warped and magnified due to gravitational lensing. So I started thinking about black holes and came up with this question for you. If we were someday able to build a theoretically perfect telescope, would we be able to resolve a billion-year-old image of ancient Earth that's been gravitationally lensed back to our telescope around a black hole half a billion light-years away? Or would the photons have diffused too much for an image to even be resolvable at that distance? Thanks, and keep up the great work.
So that's a totally awesome question, right?
Yeah. I guess the question is really sort of like, how could we take a picture of the Earth from a long time ago? Like, if we wanted to take a picture of dinosaurs or maybe the first life forms on Earth, how could we possibly do that?
Yeah, and a lot of people write in with a similar question. They ask, if the light from the stars that are really far away is just arriving now, so we're seeing stars that are a billion years old, if they're a billion light years away, does that mean that the light from the Earth is out there somewhere so other people can see it, right? And that's a common question. And it's true, like light from the dinosaurs is out there somewhere. Somebody a billion light years away is training their telescope on the Earth. They are seeing the Earth a billion years ago, which probably didn't have dinosaurs on it, or but whatever.
Yeah, and I love this idea that, because if you look, you know, most of the time light goes in a straight line, unless, and if you don't have a mirror, it gets bent by gravity. It steers around a little bit when it goes past a star. But if you want to make it do a U-turn, you got to have something really, really dense and really heavy, like a black hole. But like in principle, this idea sort of, it could work. You know, because when there are paths that light can take going around a black hole where it comes in and just does a U-turn, skims really close to the you know, it comes kind of near the event horizon, but it doesn't quite fall in, and it just slingshots around it and comes right back at you.
Help me paint the picture here, guys. So you're saying that an image of the Earth, like we're giving off photons all the time. Mm-hmm. And those photons have an image of us, like a snapshot of you know, when I took a shower 30 years ago, or when dinosaurs...
Was it an outdoor shower?
I was showering with some dinosaurs. And so that light leaves...
This is a family podcast.
I was giving some dinosaurs a shower.
Okay.
Yeah, my pet dinosaur. And so that image leaves the Earth, and you're saying that that image can actually come back to us, and possibly we can possibly capture it.
Right, and the physics here, remember, folks, is photons don't have mass, but they can be bent by gravity because gravity bends space, right? It curves space, and we see this all the time because we see light bent by heavy stuff that's between us, like dark matter stuff that's between us and the source of the light.
Yeah, and so there are paths that the light could take around a black hole to come right back to us, so it would be like looking at a mirror. If you could take a photo of a black hole up close, you'd see a bunch of rings of light around it, and those rings represent images of, you know, other stuff around the black hole that, but for the light will have followed paths that loop around it. And sometimes there will be even one, two, three loops before it comes back
no
to you.
Way.
So you'll see concentric rings around the black hole that represent images, but the images closer and closer to the black hole have made more and more loops around it.
Wow. That's
right. And so there's light that can orbit a black hole. It's not inside the event horizon, mm-hmm. but outside the event horizon, there's light that can essentially never leave, even as though it's not inside the event horizon.
Yeah, forming this like photon sphere around the black hole.
What? So wait, you're saying there's an image of, right now, there's an image of me going around a black hole multiple times?
Well, that's where we run into the practical problems here, which is that there are these paths that light can take, but you're only giving off so many photons. There's only so much light coming off of you.
You're saying I'm not very bright. Is that what you're trying to say,
right? None of us are very bright.
He's brilliant.
Yeah, no. We're, compared to how big an empty space is, none of us are very bright. I think that's true on a couple of levels. So we're giving off photons, but like, if there were a black hole right here and we illuminated you with really bright light, you might be able to pick up an image of you around there. And for you, illuminated by normal, healthy, natural lighting, the odds of picking up a photon that came off of you and circled the black hole and came back are negligible. So you just take a picture and you would be represented by none of the pixels in that photo.
Well, I think,
happen to my photon?
Let's talk about, a single photon is different, right? I mean, yeah. The question was about an image, and that's like a collection of photons that, you know, get to travel around the black hole and be reconstructed looking like Jorge. But a single photon, right? We see single photons from things a billion light years away. That's how we see stars, because photons get here. All right, photons don't get like tired. They don't run out of energy, right? Time is frozen for them. So a single Jorge photon could go around the black hole and come to Earth. It couldn't be identified easily as
exactly.
This one was from Jorge.
Because we need a whole bunch of Jorge photons to be like, oh, hey, these form the shape of his face, you know? And then we can identify him. But that takes so many that the odds of getting one of them is already slim, and the odds of getting all of them together take the same path is just too low.
Well, we can just pass that problem off to the engineers, right?
Exactly. Make a bigger mirror.
Yeah, well, I was going to say, I try to autograph all of my photons. So if you see one with my signature, that's you know it's for me. Well, so you're saying the likelihood that a photon will survive that trip to the black hole and back is negligible because will hit something, it'll run out of steam?
Because there's the one path that would come back to Earth. If you hit just the right angle on the black hole, it'll make a loop around and come back to Earth. But for almost every other angle, it'll loop around and come off in some completely different direction. It's like you have a basketball and you're trying to throw it at another basketball across the court, but it has to hit the basketball and bounce back to your hands. And so like the odds, if almost every time you try that, even if you're really good at aiming and you hit the basketball sitting on the other side of the court,
Right.
It's just going to hit it and bounce off to the side.
Not even on a YouTube video?
Well, with a YouTube video, you get to try so many times.
Did you ask Shaquille O'Neal to try that?
I did not. I had a lot of fun asking people for advice for my book, but I wasn't able to reach Mr. O'Neal. But the
did you try?
I did actually try asking a radio astronomer a question that's very very similar to this, because I was thinking black holes are all so far away. It's like the basketball shot. There's no way you could make that. You know, and the photons would take so long to get there and come back. You know, we wouldn't be able to get a picture of you. And until long after we were all gone. But there are other objects near us that we could bounce signals off of, and they aren't black holes, but maybe they could be reflective. And so I talked to a radio astronomer and said, you know, are there any big clouds or something where we could send out a signal of radio waves and they would somehow resonate and bounce back, and then we could pick them up here? And
because you want to watch TV from 40 years ago?
Yeah, I was thinking that'd be a great way. You could store a bunch of data. You just put it on the radio telescope, send it out, and then 40 years later, you know, if the thing's 20 light years away, 40 years later, that data comes back to you. You didn't have to, that could free up your hard drive space.
So like a radar or...
Exactly.
Mm. And it's like mailing something to yourself.
Yeah, and she said, no, there isn't anything out there beyond the solar system like that. But she pointed out we do use the Arecibo dish as a radar dish. We bounce signals off of asteroids and then pick up the reflection from them. So it's like, it's not just a telescope. It's like a giant flashlight. And I think that's so cool.
World's biggest flashlight. All right. So it sounds like the answer of how to take a picture of the early Earth is with a lot of luck.
That's right. Yeah. And so I think it's totally possible for those photons to go out there, come around a black hole and come back to Earth. But practically speaking, it's going to take a really bright source and a really big mirror and a huge telescope to gather those photons.
Cool. All right. Randall, we have one last question for you. We're running a bit out of time. This is more of a personal question. And I'm making it sound really serious. But I thought it'd be fun to ask you...
Are you about to propose? He's on one knee, folks.
I thought it'd be a fun question to ask you how to make a webcomic. If you had to answer the question, how to make a webcomic, what would you answer?
I don't know. I don't know what advice to give here, because to me, it seems interesting how many people kind of stumbled into it by accident. Like, you know, I was drawing comics in my notebooks. I wasn't thinking about publishing them. And then I eventually went back over them and said, oh, some of these, I want to put these online somewhere. But I wasn't really planning. I figured that career, it sounded kind of cool, but it was like not open to me, because you got to know how to come up with jokes and also how to draw. And when I was a little kid, I was thinking, oh, coming up with jokes sounds hard, and I definitely don't know how to draw. I guess cartooning is probably a bad career. So I was trying to do other things and then just stumbled into it by accident.
So are other cartoonists mad that you can be so successful just drawing stick figures?
Oh, I mean, I know it definitely saves time and hand muscles. But no, it's a thing that I just feel like I really lucked into right place, right time. You know, I was doing this and I feel really lucky that I've been able to make a career out of this without having to learn to draw faces, which has been really hard. That's something I've always had a really hard time with. So I'm in awe of people who can actually draw faces, you know, like you.
Yeah, I always imagine that you put a lot of care and a lot of attention into each stick figure. Like you think really about the pose and the...
Well, sure. It's like, you know, if I'm drawing with like five lines, I've got to make those five really good
right,
lines.
Right, yeah. And you were telling me earlier that there are actually a lot of physicists who've become cartoonists. Like you keep a list.
Oh, yeah. Well, I mean, it's just it's kind of surprising. You know, I think your degree is, you know, engineering, but close. But Bill,
are you rounding up engineering into physics?
I'm looking for things that are nearby.
He's just applied,
you know?
Physics.
You know, we're neighbors. Aside from me, there's there's Zach Wiener-Smith, who does Saturday Morning Breakfast Cereal. He has a physics degree. Bill Amond, who did Foxtrot. He also has a physics degree. Really nice guy. But my favorite fact about that is that of all of the people, of all of the physics majors who got physics degrees, but then left physics to go into cartooning, and then of those people, of the ones who were born on October 17th, I am not even like the most successful. Because it turns out Mike Judge, who did Beavis and Butthead and Office Space, he also has a physics degree and also shares my birthday.
That is wild. Have you ever met him or talked to him?
No, I haven't. I feel like he's just like my birthday twin rival out there.
Well, there you go, folks. Proof that a physics degree is guaranteed success in life, no matter what field you end up in.
Maybe only cartooning.
Or maybe it says that physics is such a terrible career choice that most people would rather do cartooning than to stay in physics.
Oh, well, you mentioned your drawing. I have a question about that. I've noticed in a lot of your recent work, you have actually really detailed and sophisticated 3D drawings of stuff. I wonder, is that something that you developed later? Have you ever thought about like modifying or adapting your style of drawing people? Or is your comic style sort of frozen now?
You know, people sometimes ask if I've taken a drawing class. And sometimes they ask it in a way like, oh, so did you do art school? And I'm like, does it look like I did art school? Sometimes they're like, have you ever thought about taking a drawing class? Like, it's like, oh, thanks. But no, the only drawing classes I've taken, I took a few technical drawing classes for like drawing blueprints and stuff and learned, you know, a little bit about how to do those kinds of shapes for like diagrams, which I think was actually really, it was helpful for comics, but almost more helpful for physics. I feel like the number of times you've had to, when you're doing a physics class, that you have to draw a 3D cube on a board to try to explain something, like cubes are hard to draw, but like you could learn to do it. So I feel like that's a drawing class that like physicists should take.
Physicists should all learn cartooning.
Just basic,
just in
you know,
case
how to draw
you need
a cube.
Career alternative there.
Yeah. I'm working on it.
Well, I think that, you know, all of your work and your books and your comics, they really sort of reflect your personality and your curiosity. And especially this latest book, How To, I think it really reflects that, you know, the mind that you have where you sort of go into a deep dive on a simple question and discover all of these interesting and amazing things about the universe. Yeah.
It's the mind of a physicist.
I'm really glad you enjoyed it. Yeah.
And I mean that in the best possible way. Well, thanks very much for joining us on the podcast and for answering our ridiculous how-to questions.
Yeah, if you're interested in getting Randall's book, just a quick reminder, it's called How To: Absurd Scientific Advice for Common Real World Problems.
That's right. It's out in hardcover from Riverhead, and we totally recommend that you pick it up.
Oh, thank you so much. Well, thank you so much for having me on. This was a lot of fun.
If you still have a question after listening to all these explanations, please drop us a line. We'd love to hear from you. You can find us at Facebook, Twitter, and Instagram at Daniel and Jorge, that's one word, or email us at feedback@danielandjorge.com. Thanks for listening, and remember that Daniel and Jorge Explain the Universe is a production of iHeartRadio. For more podcasts from iHeartRadio, visit the iHeartRadio app, Apple Podcasts, or wherever you listen to your favorite shows.